What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Podcast Producer Ben Elman.
And everyone else is gone. It's August, so Sherlyn's on vacation. A lot of people in Engadget are busy. So this week, it's me and Ben diving into some gaming news and a bunch of stuff, and stuff that really tickles our fancy. How about that? Because I know you really want to talk about Armored Core 6, Ben.
Oh my god, I have such a need for a mech game, and I had no idea that existed until I saw the Armored Core footage for myself.
We gotta love a big mech. So we'll dive into that. We also have a review on the site. So we'll talk about that game and a whole bunch of stuff from Gamescom and some announcements from Sony, including that $200 PlayStation portable thing. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and also drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. Our live stream, which we were doing Thursday mornings, is on hiatus for the summer, but we're looking to get that back. So I appreciate the folks who said that they enjoyed the live streams. That's really helpful. Keep those emails coming if you miss them. Okay, Ben, so our first piece of news this week is that Sony announced the $200 PlayStation Portal, technically another PSP, which I find to be kind of hilarious. And they teased this several months ago. We kind of talked about this because everybody was talking about the Valve Index, or everybody was talking about the Steam Deck and all these other little portable gaming systems. And I think even from the tease, it sounded like, oh, this would just stream games. And we're like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, we were talking about this in the context of like the ROG Ally and like some rumblings from Sony that there might be a handheld coming in the future, but there wasn't much information beyond that.
And we got some pictures too. So yes, you can stream games, but not in the way we thought. I think,
and that's so annoying.
It's so dumb. So the idea initially was like, okay, maybe this will let you stream games from your console, from the PlayStation 5, and from Sony's cloud services, because they have that. They had bought cloud gaming company in the early 2010s. And something Sony has been focusing on for a while. It's not just Microsoft, but it turns out.
And that would make sense, right? That would like just make to be able to stream games from your bed, but
that would make a ton of sense. But no, it turns out the $200 PlayStation Portal, which looks, by the way, like a tablet, like a it has an 8-inch tablet screen sandwiched in between the DualSense controllers. It can only stream games from the PlayStation 5. That's all.
So they need to be downloaded to your PS5, and then you can stream them to your thing. That just the first time that I saw it, I was like, oh, that looks like the center of a Switch in between two DualShock 5.
Yes, edges, yeah. So doing reading about this, I think once people saw this, I'd like to introduce another section, which we may come back to, just WYD. What are you doing? And I feel like for Sony, I have to ask this quite a lot. It's like, what are you doing, Sony? At a time when everyone is so excited about little portable gaming handhelds and in cloud gaming in general, they have this thing which can only stream games from the console. To be clear, it does sound like you can, if you have access to cloud games on your PlayStation 5, you can stream it to your console, which is then streamed to this little handheld. So technically it can play games from that cloud. But I can't imagine.
Sounds like latency to me.
That sounds like latency just waiting to happen. And I'm just looking at this thing thinking, like, what is Sony thinking? What is going on here? Because there are cheaper Android handhelds out there, which I know will not have the same level of build quality. This also has like the DualSense haptics and everything. But there are cheaper Android handhelds out there, which will work with the PlayStation Remote app, which can already, stream games from your PlayStation 5 and also hook up to, you know, the Xbox Game Pass cloud streaming and also other cloud streaming services. All this thing can do. This is just a little portal to your PlayStation 5. That's all it is. How do you feel about that, Ben?
The first thing that I thought when I read the fact that you can only stream things that are already installed on your PS5 is, one, there's another article on Engadget right now about the best SSDs that you can put in your PS5.
Sure.
But also, it just like conjured an image of someone who has a little bit more money than sense, like being able to play PS5 games from their bed
from anywhere,
because their PS5 is all the way over there in their big house. I'm thinking of like a music producer or, you know, like, you know, one of those rappers that's really into gaming or something. And like, they would be posting pictures of this on Instagram or something of like, oh, got the new like PlayStation Portal. But for a lot of other folks, especially like living the way I am right now, where I am trying not to have a TV in the living room, just so like if people are over, we're hanging out, we're like interacting with each other, not like watching TV or something. I would have a TV in my bedroom, which would mean that my console is also in my bedroom, which means that I don't need a PlayStation Portal.
Which also, I feel like, good on you, Ben, for trying to have, like, a conversational hangouts with your friends. But I do feel like that calculus is always weird because, then you're screwing up your sleeping space, your relaxing space. But
I mean, my sleeping space is already screwed up because I am currently podcasting from my bedroom. Like, at least a third of my bedroom is my workspace.
This is just how we live now. So I get it. I get it. If you want to have a screen out of something, at least have it be the main room. I don't think you need to go that high end, Ben, for like a rap producer or something, or like a music producer, because this thing is $200. I've talked to people who bought the Steam Deck, which retails starting double this price. And personally, I got the Steam Deck because I'm like, I like to PC game. I don't always want to sit at my desk here to do that. And my Steam Deck was like the top end one that started at like $650. I'm going to put Aaron Suporis from Engadget on blast here because he's in a one bedroom apartment in New York. And he was like, oh yeah, I'm totally buying this because I don't always want to be playing on my PlayStation 5 in my living room. So there is an audience for it. I think the phrase I have in mind here though is missed opportunity. I feel like Sony could have done so much more.
The price is good. The fact that this is just $200, especially after the PSVR 2 came out, and it was almost or a little more than the console itself. Can we fact check that?
It's definitely more. It was either $500 or $550. I'm going to look this up right now.
Okay, so like a comparable cost.
Yeah.
Okay, so a comparable cost to the console itself. This other peripheral is now very well priced. It is priced under the Nintendo Switch, even, that I compared it to. So that
not quite the Switch Lite. The Switch Lite, I believe, has been at $200, but I have to look that up again, too. Yeah.
Still, like,
$200.
It is a decent price for something that can only stream installed games or maybe, like, streamed from a central server game with significant latency.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're also paying for the Sony brand name here, too, and the build quality. Certainly, this thing looks much cooler than those, you know, very cheap Android handhelds from random Chinese companies. Like, this looks like higher quality. So you were definitely paying for that. But you know what? This feels like a Chromebook situation, you know, where it's like you're just paying for like a device that can do one thing. And I guess that price makes sense. But I'm looking at the Switch Lite here, which is a beautiful little console, so cute, so portable, can play any Switch game. That game can play Tears of the Kingdom for $200 in your hands. It just seems weird, and I have to ask again, what are you doing, Sony? We're looking at the rest of the specs on this thing. It has a 3.5mm jack, thank God. What it doesn't have is Bluetooth.
So, yeah, and let's get into that, because
what are you doing,
this was, and like Sony announced this along with a few other peripherals, including some earbuds, and we were talking just before we started recording the show about how, like, yes, you can get the earbuds to connect wirelessly to the PlayStation Portal, but it is through, like, this new...
The Pulse Explore earbuds, which also cost $200.
Okay, so if you want to get fully kitted out, that's going to be a full $400 for a fully, like, wireless PlayStation experience.
Yeah.
Okay, so these connect wirelessly to the PlayStation Portal. They do not connect wirelessly to the PS5. Is that correct?
That is correct, because the PlayStation, the Pulse Explore, and the new Pulse Elite headset, they are using a new wireless technology called PlayStation Link. And if Sony loves anything, it is proprietary technology formats, which screw up all the tech you already have. So no Bluetooth, but PlayStation Link. And yeah, for the PlayStation 5, if you buy one of these things, you'll need a USB adapter to use PlayStation Link. I think there are also some, there's a lot of rumors out there that Sony's working on like a slimmed down version of the PlayStation 5, as they tend to do.
I'm looking forward to that. I don't have a PS5 right now, and I'm thinking about getting one, but I'm waiting for this possible announcement.
Just wait a bit for that. But that sort of thing, it seems like if they can get this tech into like a really cheap little handheld like this, it's just a matter of time. Like, they just didn't have the time to, it didn't exist when the PlayStation 5 was being developed. So they could just plug that tech right into whatever the new slim version of the PlayStation 5 is. So it's just one of those weird things. But again, this is a $200 portable gaming system that doesn't have Bluetooth, which is the, if you already have wireless headsets, you probably have Bluetooth. If you're lucky enough to have cans or something, then you could plug in your 3.5 millimeter cable. Thank God for that. But
speaking of cans, let's not forget to talk about the over-ear headphones that they announced as well.
Yes, the over-ears. Yeah, I mentioned that. That was the Pulse Elite over-ear headphones. What is really cool about the headphones, and this is the Sony thing, I'm like, well, your flagship new little portal project seems like a huge miss. But kind of on the down low, Sony's like, oh, by the way, we're like the first company to bring planar magnetic drivers to wireless earbuds. And you're like, what, Sony? You did what now? Because I think audio geeks know there are different types of speakers and headphone technologies, right? There's dynamic, electrostatic, and then planar magnetic is like the other one, which tends to have, right? They're thinner. They're supposedly more accurate. Yeah,
you're right, because I was coveting, man, I don't even remember the model number of these planar magnetic headphones, but they were wired. And that's never been a problem for me because I am a 3.5 millimeter boy.
That's the thing. First of all, I had to like readjust my hands. Like, oh, wait a minute. We're in a world where you can have wireless earbuds with planar magnetic stuff. I have some big giant cans here, which are super heavy, but sound incredible because they use this like magnetic technology. And there's some good descriptions of that stuff out there. So I'd say just go look that up. But the thing is, technically, these should be less bulky. These should give you higher quality sound and also less distortion because the sound is coming through like something sandwiched between two magnets that are like perfectly aligned. This is the first set of wireless earbuds I've seen with this technology. There are other in-ear monitors from other companies. I believe Wirecutter and a couple of places have mentioned this. But you can get a wired earbud with planar magnetic for under $200 these days. So that's wired. So for Sony to have actually a pair that are $200, that's actually pretty cool. And and these buds, even though the PlayStation Portal doesn't have Bluetooth, these buds do support Bluetooth, so you can have support, you can plug into your phone and into the PlayStation 5 at the same time, I believe.
So I guess some serious Sony heads can also just use these earbuds as their like daily earbuds. Hopefully they have a microphone too, so you can use them for phone calls and everything.
They also support both of these headsets, the buds and the new headset support that new PlayStation Link technology supports low latency, lossless audio. So it's supposed to be higher quality. But this is all very feels reminiscent of like the mini disc days. And I remember in the 90s when I used to covet the mini disc players, that they're so adorable. They're so cute. They could holding digital music on tiny little discs, and you had to get them from Japan. They weren't really widely sold everywhere. I really wanted mini discs so hard, but as a standard, it kind of died because it was only supported by Sony.
You know where mini discs stayed relevant for a while? In radio.
Yeah.
Because there were like field recorders that used mini discs for a long time from like the late 90s to like the mid 2000s or so, until we started getting SD cards that were like big enough to really hold large audio files.
I seem to record that. A lot of audio people I know also just use like giant DAT recorders, which just record to tape. So that was nice too. Yeah.
So when you were talking, when you initially like introduced the idea of the PlayStation Portal to me, when we were planning this episode, you were saying that Sony is bad at new devices sometimes. Many times.
I think Sony makes baffling decisions, hence the new section, What Are You Doing, Sony?
Okay. So let's go through that. So like the Vita and the PSP are from an era where I just wasn't paying that much attention to Sony. You have professed your love for the Vita several times.
I love the Vita.
Just this year, just in the last couple of months.
Sony's a baffling company.
So you said the PSP was underserved.
Yeah.
Can you explain what you mean by underserved?
Sure. So by underserved, specifically, I think this is the PSP. Sony just didn't push it enough. It had a pretty decent audience. There was a decent selection of games. But I think what it really came down to was that by the time Sony was like, okay, the PSP is doing fine, let's do the Vita. So the PlayStation Vita was released in Japan in December 2011. It hit the US a couple of months later. It had an OLED screen. You know, it had the companies like it had the basic PlayStation controls. It even had analog sticks, although they were more like sliding analog thingies. They didn't really click in very well. It had shoulder buttons and stuff. But like it was a beautiful looking device. Sony's a company which I think can make some beautiful devices. Like their consumer design can be amazing at times. And hey, now everyone's excited about the Steam Deck and all these other little portable things, but I think the Vita was super powerful for the time. It had a great screen. I spent at least over 100 hours playing Persona 4 Golden on that thing. Not every game was great. I think there was an Uncharted game that just didn't end up doing very well on the Vita. But I feel like Sony had this thing, and then they had the PlayStation 4. It was PlayStation 3 before it, because this was even before the PlayStation 4 launched. But they had this and then the PlayStation 4, and they're like, oh, that's our focus, right? What is this portable stuff? Who cares? Fast forward a couple of years, and Nintendo releases the Switch and just, like, dominates
drinks
everything.
Drinks their whole milkshake.
And it's, Nintendo was into handhelds before, but Nintendo's key insight was that, hey, we don't, I think with the Wii, they were like, yeah, we don't have to play the same game as everybody else. And then they were like, well, you know what? Portables are getting fast enough where we don't even really need to focus as much on the actual putting powerful hardware in the console. We could just make this thing fully portable. But anyway, the PS Vita was there, and Sony just like, it just slowly died. And I think it's very hackable. You can, I believe, run Android or run things on it to emulate games. So it was decently powerful for the time. It was just one of those things that Sony did. It was like, you have this beautiful product. I don't understand why you're not pushing it. And then Sony corporate will do things like release some baffling neck speakers, which I did.
And I didn't remember what you were talking about until I looked at the like timestamp on that article. And I remember you talking about it in the fall of 2019, because we had just restarted the podcast right around then.
Yep. Yep.
And these are not like the headphones that also have like a little necklace kind of attachment that I had seen like people on the subway
that was before
in New York
we
City,
had
like wearing
earbuds.
And stuff.
Yeah.
So like that was a way of, I think, like having a bit more like chips and stuff on board that you needed for like wireless connectivity. But no, these are actual, like this is a kind of neck ring. It looks like a
We called it a
personal
cow
flotation device.
Yeah, it's a personal flotation device. It also looked like a cow collar, or cattle collar or something. There's speakers
and it plays music to you.
It plays music. There's speakers you wear on your neck. Like that's it. That's the idea. I forget like where Sony is. I believe they re-release those and have like a different version of those now. But when I did it, again, this was 2019, there was no Bluetooth compatibility. To connect anything to it, you had to plug in a 3.5 millimeter or optical cable into a wireless receiver. So that's also what you need to do if you want to connect it to your TV or your computer. And it sounded fine, but it just seemed like an absolutely baffling device at the time. There are arguments now I've seen from people, I think, post-pandemic. We were like, yeah, maybe I wouldn't mind like a little speaker that I just wear on me all day. Even though
it looks very future, like the pictures in this article look very future, kind of like someone wearing these like Sony neck speakers along with a like Starfleet like singlet uniform.
Sure,
or something.
I guess like if this was the 90s and you're like, what? Give me some future looking stuff. Speakers you wear in your neck. Sure. If somehow that is more convenient to you than headphones or tiny little earbuds or something. Because earbuds existed in the 90s. They just weren't wireless yet.
Yeah.
It just seems like one of those over-design things. I think Sony sometimes over-designs and doesn't understand why it's making a product. And then they're like, oh, nobody actually wants this. Who could have imagined? We could have imagined, Sony. We could have told you what's going on there. The PlayStation Portal kind of reminds me of that. I did actually just recently write a piece. If you want to hear my full thoughts on Sony, because I ranted at Sony,
That was the thing that made them send you a kind of a little nasty gram, right?
A little nasty gram.
Like they were frustrated with you.
Yeah, in 2021, it was a big anniversary year for Sony, I believe. It was, I think, the 75th anniversary. And I was trying to like just write a story about like, hey, what's going on with Sony right now? Because it is a company I grew up liking. I think before Apple became a thing, before the iPod dominated consumer technology, Sony
and
was
you
like,
accused them of having lost the plot.
I lost the plot. My piece was, can Sony reclaim its former glory? The deck is PlayStation saved it, but can Sony still innovate like it used to? And I think it's worth a read because I kind of walk through a lot of the things Sony completely missed out on. They missed out on portable music because they were so focused on the MIDI disc and memory stick Walkman devices, things that technology that only they owned. When the iPod came out, Sony released a Walkman that same month that had a 128 megabyte memory stick, the largest available at the time.
Okay, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, the way that a lot of these like big manufacturers do things seems to be kind of like guessing in the same way that like a soccer goalie guesses when defending a penalty kick.
It's all guessing.
And so you're accusing them of saying like, oh, you totally lost the plot, because after the fact, you're like, how could you not see the kick going for the top right corner?
Well, I think
they
you could see
had to guess
what you could see them doing, what they guess, Ben. What always happens is Sony's like, how do we make this our thing? How do we lock this down into our devices, our system, our formats, right? And that has always been a complaint against Sony. Like Minidisc, people like Minidisc, but CDs were out there and they fit more things and you just have a slightly bigger player. It wasn't the biggest deal in the world. When Memory Stick came out, there were flash drives. There were other ways to store data, but Sony had to do it their way, you know? And it was like, it's a very specific thing, and it's that sort of restriction, which I think, you're kind of trying to predict where the goal is going. But also, if you are forcing it to be under your term so much, it's almost like you're trying to like demand to pick up and move the goal at the same time, which I think is that is not great. And then the crux of this piece, by the way, is that Sony fell victim to the innovator's dilemma. And for decades, Sony ruled the consumer electronics world. Their badge on anything, on speakers, on TVs, TVs in particular, Sony just ruled. Like their CRT TVs, their Trinitron CRTs were like the best you could ever get since the early 70s. Like the early Trinitrons came out back then. They looked better than most other TVs. Those things lasted decades. Sony completely missed it out on the idea of flat screens, because they were so committed to making big CRTs, which is what they're
extremely deep TVs.
I love them. And people right now are going back and loving them. But
yeah, so I actually saw like a little TikTok or something from someone who went to their local like broadcast station and got these broadcast grade like monitor TVs.
Studio
and
monitors.
Apparently, studio monitors that are fantastic for like NES.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. You need some like really specific like connector adapters, but these make the NES look so crisp.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, those are cherished things right now. If you have access to any old CRTs, especially studio monitors, especially Sony Trinitrons from the 90s.
And this guy got them for free too.
They're being resold for quite a bit online these days too. So this is the whole thing. But anyway, Sony missed the plot on digital audio. They missed the plot on phones, because Sony Ericsson phones was like a whole thing.
True.
For a while. I had one of those. I loved my Sony Ericsson, but then it was just a phone that was like a pretty good phone, but didn't think about like where phones could be going, you know. And Apple once again came in and did that. I think even on the console side, like they've been doing pretty good, but I think the PlayStation 3 was kind of a miss for them compared to like what the Xbox 360 did in terms of multiplayer and everything. They just keep kind of missing. But now it feels like, most of Sony's business is basically PlayStation. The vast majority of it is PlayStation. And then the stuff they get from movies. So they still have the Spider-Man license that they're sharing with Marvel. They still have some Marvel characters. So that stuff is making money for them. They're just in a really weird place. But anyway, we come back around to the PlayStation Portal just being a baffling device. I'm looking forward to testing it at some point. But you know what, folks? Let me know what you think. Because Sony's just a company that kind of irks me sometimes. Like, I can love them, but then I sometimes think they are just completely, completely insane in terms of what they do. But hey, Apple does this too. We did rail against the $1,000 monitor stand. You know, those things, all these companies kind of have these weird blind spots. But Sony in particular is one I think that can be capable of so much good and just make some simple mistakes. One more bit of Sony news today. The company announced that they're acquiring Audese, a company that makes planar magnetic headphones. So I guess that makes a ton of sense after this whole discussion. Audese says that this acquisition will give it a wider reach, which certainly makes sense if they're going to be part of Sony. And it also seems like Sony is not keeping this technology exclusive. Audese currently makes headsets for Xbox and other platforms too. This is a bit surprising because we don't really see Sony buying small companies much these days. But, you know, betting on planar magnetic audio drivers, I think, is going to make a lot of sense. Everybody's trying to figure out ways to make headphones sound better. And this technology is a massive leap forward once you hear it. So it makes sense for Sony to take a bet on this right now.
So there was a lot more news that came out of Gamescom. And I want to go in that direction because I want to talk about Armored Core. Armored Core. So what was it? It was like maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago now that I saw a little clip of Armored Core. Again, it was probably on TikTok. I spend way too much time on TikTok.
TikTok's good.
Someone just throw me a life raft for that. And I'm like, what is this game? Like, this looks pretty cool. I saw people in the comments saying like, oh, is this a Gundam game? Like, this looks really amazing. I was like, wow. I can't believe that I haven't played a giant robot game in a long time. Also, at the time, I've just had like giant robots on the mind. I had been thinking about that Cartoon Network series, Megas XLR. I've been thinking about this other series that I saw like on like, I think it was Fox, like after school cartoons, Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot. Yeah, just big robots on the mind. And Armored Core came at the right time.
Perfect time for this. And the full name of this game, by the way, is Armored Core 6, Fires of Rubicon. And this is the first time, this is the first new Armored Core game in almost a decade. It's kind of wild. Like, after From Software saw huge success with the Souls games, so with Dark Souls and Bloodborne, and most recently Elden Ring, they had Sekiro, which is their sort of like, it's also a ninja stealth game, kind of in that vein. But now they're going back to their roots, to Armored Core.
Yeah. Because Armored Core is like an old franchise for them. It's one of the things that they started with in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so after seeing this gameplay, and then I looked at like a few like preview videos on YouTube, including one from, let's see if I can pronounce this right, Vaatividya. That's V-A-A-T-I-V-I-D-Y-A. This guy with a very calming voice just did like a 46-minute preview of Armored Core. This is incredible. However, I have never played a FromSoft game. I've just heard people talk about how fantastically difficult all the Soulsborne games are. And so I was like, okay, I really want to play the giant robot game.
But is
it going to be so hard? So we see in this review on Engadget by Igor Bonifacic, and I also asked some folks that I'm in contact with, I like queried a Discord that I'm on, okay, I want to play the giant robot game from FromSoft. Is it going to be fantastically difficult? And I was told, no. Igor's review backs this up. It is definitely something that you have to get good at, but it is not like a get good kind of game.
Well, you have to get good at the systems is the thing.
But you're going to have to learn the controls, but it is not something that is so like punishingly difficult like Elden Ring or Bloodborne is, that you're going to be like dying 100 times before you beat the first boss.
I don't know. Did those people you asked, did they play the game?
Do you mean Armored Core?
Have they played this Armored Core yet? Because a lot of the other reviews on things like, oh, buddy, strap yourself in for 3-hour-long boss fights where you throw yourself against the boss until you figure out the thing that cracks.
Okay, but Igor himself said that he did, you know, he might have done a boss fight like 10 times or something.
I've heard 3 to 4 hours from some people, so.
Well, okay,
Hey, we'll give it a shot. Give it a shot. Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
I'm definitely going to give it a shot. But the thing that I'm looking for is just like a game that isn't so incredibly difficult that like if I lose against a boss maybe two or three times, I start to understand what is happening. And so instead of losing like 25% of the way through the boss fight, I get to 45 or 50% of the boss fight by the third go at it or so. In this Discord that I also queried, I asked like, okay, has anyone else like played an Armored Core game? Igor also said like, this is his first Armored Core game. This would be my first Armored Core game as well. And I asked like, okay, so is it fantastically difficult? And like, what is this like in relation to like other video games or other FromSoft games? And one of the folks that responded to me said, okay, so imagine there is a giant mech game and there is like giant mech fighting, but it is also a little bit like Gran Turismo, where you spend a lot of time in the garage, like tweaking your builds and figuring out the best way to get through a certain section of the game or a certain boss fight. And I have to admit, that's something that actually sold it to me. I grew up with a lot of car guys. They were always interested in like Gran Turismo and like all of the other racing games with very customizable cars. I was never interested in, you know, finding this cold air intake versus this other thing versus this turbo setup. But I did like the core mechanic of tweaking things to make sure that to like make the bars go a little bit higher.
I think just give it a shot. Like, but do you have any of the newer systems to play this? It's Xbox, PS5.
I have access. I'm dating someone with a PS5.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go. You have access.
I mean, that's how I played Control in my preferred way, too. Like, I didn't even know that I got, like, more than 70% of the way through Control when I was streaming it to my Switch, but I had to quit on that because the latency was just so high. So I started Control again from the very beginning on the PS5 with the better graphics, and I was much happier with it.
That's the way to play it. Well, if you want to like wet your beak a little, Ben, before you get into this game, I do want to recommend Into the Breach to you. I don't know if you've played that, but that's a little isometric strategy game.
Oh, yeah, that's also the one from the FTL developers,
From the
right?
FTL folks. Yeah, that is a great game. Also pretty tough, but I think we'll... It doesn't give you the sense of like controlling a giant mech like Armored Core 6 does. I am very excited for this too, by the way. But I think it may scratch some itches. Like, it does have a good sense of like scale, I think would be a good way to put it. But right now I've been thinking like, should I get Baldur's Gate 3? Or should I get Armored Core 6? And I'm still playing Tears of the Kingdom, but I just need like another thing to spend some time on. And you know what?
I think we need to get Jess on talk about Baldur's Gate, even though it's like it might be a month late or something, because there's much to do in Baldur's Gate. People are still figuring out like really interesting mechanics. I just heard about this thing, this strategy that people are calling Owlbear from the Top Rope, where you make a huge stack of boxes. You get a druid to stand on top of those boxes and shapeshift into an owlbear, which is one of the like largest heaviest animals that they can shapeshift into.
Yeah.
And then if they do a certain attack that negates fall damage, you can just like meteor strike these enemies that might be like way below you and do, you know, massive, massive damage.
I feel like I'm there. I may get there, but I also look at Armored Core 6. I'm like, again, giant mechs. I've not been here in a while, and
absolutely.
I'm a little sick of some of the like the PC RPG stuff. Like I remember getting really excited for Neverwinter Nights when that came out, and just was not into it. Like it's not the same as like a JRPG or something. So that just took a while to grow on. So anyway, maybe we'll both.
Yeah,
play
let's
this.
Get on to other we'll, stuff. We'll talk Tell about me about this huge 57-inch monitor.
Well, you know, one you brought up Jess. We will probably have Jess on in a bit because we will need to talk about Starfield in a couple of weeks. So maybe we can get her thoughts on that and her thoughts on Baldur's Gate and everything. But yeah, you know what, folks? If you are planning to get Armored Core 6, let us know. Are you a newbie? Whatever. Podcast and gadget.com.
Yeah, send your friend code. But tell me about these 57-inch ultra-wide gaming monitor.
Well, yeah, Samsung just unveiled this ultra-wide. It's a dual 4K gaming monitor. So not just 57 inches, not just 4K, but is effectively giving you two 32-inch 4K screens. You know, God bless your GPU. Like, whatever GPU is powering this thing, like, Godspeed. Good luck with playing any game natively. But this continues Samsung's trend of just making big-ass screens and big-ass monitors. I reviewed the 55-inch, basically a TV, but the 55-inch gaming monitor that they released earlier this year. That thing was kind of a bear. This thing seems even wilder. For $2,500, it is a mini LED screen with HDR 1000, which is pretty good. That's 1000 nits of peak brightness. Has 10-bit color processing, 240 hertz refresh rate, which is what you want, a 1 millisecond response time, lots of ports. You'll also get AMD's FreeSync Premium Pro with variable refresh rate. Hey, this sounds pretty great, but this is the Odyssey Neo G9. Let me tell you, folks. Right now, I'm sitting in front of a 49-inch PC gaming monitor. I'm in the midst of like testing and reviewing LG's latest Ultra Gear, which also, I believe this one, don't know if this one has OLED, actually. I have to double check here. But this one also has like a super huge screen, super fast response rate. These things are amazing for games, you know, especially for games that take up this full thing. But, oh, man, I don't know about the Samsung. Like, have you used an ultra-wide display yet, Ben?
I have not used an ultra-wide display. I don't know how it would work with my actual like workflow.
Oh, you only
like,
need
yes,
desk.
It would give me a huge amount of timeline mm-hmm. to edit all of my podcasts on.
I also think,
but
yeah,
like one of the big things that I do. Okay, so two questions or two thoughts in general. One, I feel like this is going to end up being used by a lot of sim enthusiasts.
Sure.
So like flight sim, Formula One sim, kind of like. People who are really into those kinds of games that need a very wide field of view. The second question, and that's something like more central to my workflow, is how are you going to subdivide this screen?
It's hard. It's impossible.
I'm on a Mac right now. I use a program called Magnet to give me the functionality that Windows has had for a while, where you can snap Windows to half the screen or a quarter of the screen or something. This is so big.
Good luck.
How do you like make it? How do you subdivide your Windows
on
this
God.
Thing?
That's all I can say.
Because what I do is I will drag the window over to the edge of the screen and it will just snap. If you have so much screen and you want to keep something in the center, yes, I know that you can use hotkeys. I guess you're going to have to get really
you
good at hotkeys.
You will have to figure
keys.
Out a system. Yeah.
Otherwise, if you're not good at the hotkeys, if you don't want to get good at the hotkeys, how are you going to do this? Is there a way of doing it just with like a mouse?
It depends.
I'm not sure.
I mean, with Windows, it's all easier on Macs. Like that makes everything harder. I will say you will not be getting this screen. Don't buy this monitor unless you specifically know exactly what you want to do with it. With these ultra wides, especially these extreme ultra wides, because there are ultra wides that are like 21:9, which is what I typically live with. I typically use a 34-inch ultra wide, which is sort of like two 24-inch monitors side by side. And it's great. I love it because I don't have to turn my head too much, but I get a lot of workable, you know, workspace and stuff. Now that I'm testing this 49-inch, I really have to like lean my head. I have to look all the way in the corner to see what's going on the left side of this monitor. I can just imagine like that whole experience being even more extreme with a 57-inch. So anyway, this thing is very cool. And I highly recommend ultra-wides to people. When you go to Best Buy, when you go to any stores, like just sit in front of one of these things. It is much better than buying like two monitors and doing that whole thing. But I also don't think most people will need to go to these extremes. Like the 49, even this 49-inch is taking up, I have a very large desk. This 49-inch is basically taking up the entire desk. And I have to like do a special arch to get my microphone around it and everything. My 34-inch, perfectly in the center. I could put a couple windows side by side. That's all I really want and still really immersive for games. But I am intrigued by this. And I want to know, I want ultrawides to be more popular. So, yeah. This is really cool. Maybe once I clear off this LG, I could just ping Samsung and be like, hey, just send me one of those. I just want a little look. But I will say, folks, like I've been playing a lot of Halo Infinite. I've been playing a lot of Cyberpunk on this LG. Man, is it immersive. Man, it is almost like VR without like the full, you know, putting on the headset and stuff. But this Samsung monitor at dual 4K, you're going to need a hell of a video card. Like that is... You need two 4090s? you know, like you need a 4090, and be careful with your specs. You can't just crank that all the way. So I want to see how people use this and what they're using to power it. But anyway, we've got a bunch of other gaming news. I just want to quickly mention Atari announced the 2600 Plus, which is a miniature console that plays 2600 and 7800 game carts. This comes after Atari launched the VCS, which was their little like other mini console, which they discontinued and played some Atari games. I have very little love for the Atari era, Ben. And I feel like the company right now is just really trying hard to get people back there. Do you have any love for this or any of these games?
No, I have to be honest. This might be before my time.
It's definitely before your time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's before my really, time. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really, my like intro to console gaming was with the N64. So anything before that is stuff that I had to like expose myself to on purpose. It was not just ambient. The thing that I'm really curious about in terms of this Atari 2600 Plus is how much is it really adding to the balance sheet? I want to see like numbers on like a boring document that say, okay, how much money are you actually making on this?
How much are you making? Who has these games? Who has the carts? Are they still in working condition? I grew up on the NES. That was the thing that made me fall in love with tech and games in general. And man, I have a hard time going back and playing a lot of NES games because just the tech was not there. You know, there's some really great ones. All the Marios are good. All the Zeldas are good. What else was good? The early Metal Gear Solids. There was a Little Nemo game that was fantastic. There were some great platformers back
like
then.
Like Little Nemo
Little
in Dreamland?
Nemo in Dreamland has a fantastic NES game. I spent hours playing that with my friends at the time. But really, the console that really brought it all home was the SNES for me. You know, the SNES and Genesis era really just like, oh, these are like arcade quality graphics right here. So I have very little love for the NES these days. I can't imagine going back to this. Let us know, folks. Is this interesting to you? We also saw some news at Gamescom. NVIDIA announced DLSS 3.5, which is a slightly updated version of their AI upscaling tech. So DLSS has had a journey. You know, initially it started out being like, hey, we will render your games at a lower resolution, use AI to kind of upscale them and make them look better without like taking up all the horsepower needed to render the game at a high resolution. So say you want to play a game in 4K, DLSS could let you render it at like 1440p. That's the horsework the GPU does. And then with AI upscaling, you know, brings it up to 4K, and it looks pretty good. I actually know a lot of people who prefer playing games with DLSS versus natively in 4K or something, because you'll get higher frame rates and all sorts of stuff. This new DLSS has ray trace improvements, so it'll make ray trace games look better with a feature called...
I just bring everything back to Control because I love the world of that game so much. But anyway,
this
is
a new feature called Ray Reconstruction. And I'm just going to quote NVIDIA here because they're saying, quote, hand-tuned denoisers with an NVIDIA... It will replace hand-tuned denoisers with an NVIDIA supercomputer-trained AI network that generates higher quality pixels in between sampled rays. So your ray trace games look better. There are some demo photos that they have here, and there's actually a video at the bottom of the post around this. Ray trace shadows, ray trace corners and edges just look better, which is a good thing because I think like ray tracing is the thing you want to turn on. As I've been testing this monitor, I've been cranking up the resolution all the way and Cyberpunk all the way with ray tracing overdrive, and sometimes brings my frame rate to a crawl, but man, does it look good. So this is a good feature, and what's really cool is that this ray tracing feature will work on all the RTX cards, so including the 3000 series and the 2000, although I don't know what a huge benefit you'll get there. DLSS 3, which launched last year, only worked on the new 40 series card. So this is a weird thing where you'll get some features of DLSS 3, which was mainly frame interpolation to give you more frames for like GPU-bound games, I believe that was a thing. It's kind of cool. Better ray tracing. Also, take a look at some news around NVIDIA's records mega profit. Thanks to its AI chip business, their earnings were yesterday as we're recording this. And let me just run some numbers here because NVIDIA's on top.
Yeah, no, it's huge. And like it seems like they pretty well weathered the transition from crypto to AI, where like they're just still on top.
They were never, I mean, they were never really pumping crypto. Crypto was a thing that happened to them because of the power of GPUs. But for years, NVIDIA has also been using GPUs and their tech to build like AI chips. And now it's finally paying off.
Okay, so the stock was up.
Yes.
It happened to be up because of crypto.
Yes.
But they were really pumping AI.
Yep.
And now this is,
is happening.
Chickens so, coming home to roost for them in the good way.
From Steve Dent and Engadget, NVIDIA announced revenue of $13.51 billion in the second quarter, more than doubling the $6.7 billion it made last year, crushing market expectations. It also earned $6.18 billion in profit, nine times the $656 million it made a year ago, or 2 years ago. That is...
I should have invested in NVIDIA.
Dang
it.
They're doing really well. There's also a lot of reporting that this may not last for them because other people, pretty much every company is racing to make AI chips too. So I hope they don't fall prey to the innovator's dilemma. But all the work that they've been doing so far has paid off quite a bit for NVIDIA. And honestly, when I review graphics cards these days too, it's like there's a little extra level of polish I get from the NVIDIA stuff that I don't from AMD's. Almost every time I review an AMD graphics card, it's like, okay, how will this crash my system? One of the last ones I just couldn't review because it kept crashing my my motherboard. And it's just like one of those things. I think NVIDIA's in a really, really good spot. And actually, related to this news, NVIDIA also announced that a group of modders, Half-Life 2 modders, are working on remastering Half-Life 2 with RTX, so giving it ray tracing and all the RTX features on their new video cards. You could check out some sample photos at Engadget. It looks like a huge improvement. Ray tracing changes everything.
The head crabs have so much more texture to them.
That's it. It's texture. It's lighting. It's the way things, being in a room with ray tracing just looks next generation. I've played some Minecraft levels with full ray tracing and the Quake 2 thing. It's like even simplistic games like those like look mind blowing once you add the power of like realistic reflections and realistic shadows and stuff. So
this will be cool. I mean, you can mod Minecraft to the point where it will make your PC chug because it's so much of a sandbox. I think it's cool that people are remaking Half-Life 2 with ray tracing just the same way that there was that project for Black Mesa, the original Half-Life remake as well. I think that Half-Life in general is just a great platform for bringing stuff into new technology. Because isn't that the idea of Half-Life? I've said to friends for a really long time that like the really tired trope that you see on Reddit a lot of like Valve can't count to three is because Half-Life is a platform for new technology.
Always has been, yeah.
Half-Life 2 was a platform for a new physics engine. Half-Life Alyx was a way of Valve to say, hey, look at our Valve Index, like really high-end VR product.
Look at what you can do in VR, and they did some amazing things with it. What is funny is that so many Half-Life fans I know have not played Half-Life Alyx because you don't need the Index. You can use any VR headset to get into it as long as you have a PC powerful enough to play it. But that game is also actually very important to Half-Life lore. It makes a lot of changes. And I cannot wait till more people play it so we can actually talk about it. I don't know what Valve is doing. They should just license that to Sony and just like get that on PlayStation 5. Get it on PSVR 2. That's what everybody would really want, I think, right? That'd at least be a way for you to play it, Half-Life Alyx, still good. I still have very good memories of playing that whole thing.
At the very beginning of the pandemic.
That actually was very, very fitting. In final gaming news, the voice of Mario, Charles Martinet himself, announced this week, or Nintendo announced, that he'll be stepping down from the role of Mario. He's going to be a Mario ambassador, but he will not be voicing the character anymore. Something he's been doing for the past 27 years. So that's pretty wild. Well, actually, maybe even longer than that, actually, because he was doing it since 1991. Nintendo had this thing at trade shows. I forget what they called it. It was like it was real-time Mario. It was just a Mario face, and he was like behind some boxes or something somewhere, basically marionetting this Mario digital puppet, and he would like do the voice and say, "It's a me," and hello, and do the whole thing. That was 1991. So I posted a video of this thing.
He's been the voice of Mario for the entire time I've been alive, yeah, basically.
Pretty much. But it's also wild to go back and look at this thing because it's like a digital Mario face. It's a Super Mario 64 face in 91. The video we have is from 92 at SCES, which was, I think, South CES. That's what it was in Atlanta. Yeah, it was a thing.
So you said that this is actually a very interesting case where Mr. Charles Martinet might want to license his voice to AI. Can you tell me more about that idea?
I mean, hey, it's not like AI is going anywhere. The issues we have now that the WGA and the actors are talking about is AI being used to being used in ways that won't compensate them, like having their images taken or something, or performances reused over time. But there should definitely be a role for, I think, actors, especially voice actors, to license their tech out. We've talked about that when it comes to James Earl Jones, who basically licensed a digital replication of his voice to do Darth Vader moving forward. We don't know how long that's going to last. But Charles Martinet has been such a singular voice for Mario and other characters in Nintendo, by the way. He does Wario, he does Luigi, he does Waluigi, he does the baby versions of those characters. He does,
yeah.
He does some different enemies, so I just feel like, well, this guy's been so indispensable. What if he could just keep doing these voices for 100 years, and what if like you paid him and his estate for the privilege of doing that? I think that would actually be pretty fair to Charles Martinet and others. What we did learn, and Nintendo confirmed this, that Super Mario Brothers Wonder, the new game coming in October, is not using Charles Martinet's voice. And people kind of noticed that. They noticed the wahs and the wahoos were different in the promo video for Super Mario Brothers Wonder. And also there's a WarioWare 2 game, WarioWare Move It, where people noticed the voice sounded different. Nintendo confirmed that he won't be doing the voice in Wonder. We also don't know what will be his last game. So maybe it'll be the last one that came out. Maybe it'll be Odyssey. I don't know.
Well, thank you, Charles, for all of your contributions, even if they were mostly monosyllabic.
I mean, he had some good phrases. You know, he introduced a whole generation to Mario. I just hope I hope the voice moving forward is better than just Chris Pratt in the Mario movie. Let's move on to some other news, and you will get a handful of things, actually. We didn't do an episode last week, but last week Microsoft announced it's going to be holding a special event on September 21st in New York. Definitely going to be a Surface event. This is like the time of the year when Microsoft unveils new hardware, so I will hopefully be on the ground there to check that out. I don't know if you have any thoughts about Microsoft Surface hardware at this point, Ben. I just feel like they got to do something. I feel like they're in a weird little rut right now. And Apple's M series chips, especially like the M1 MacBook Air, just took a lot of wind out of Microsoft sales. Do you have any feelings about the Surface at this point?
To be honest, no.
Yeah. And you should. I feel like you should because you're a you're a Mac user, right?
But yeah, no, I am a Mac user.
So I guess that makes sense. But man,
I mean, I've thought about getting like one of the cheaper Surface.
But you shouldn't. You should just get an iPad. You should just get an iPad so you can sidecar it to your Mac and have another display. Like
isn't that the problem?
That's the problem.
There isn't enough of a compelling argument for Surface things, even if you are like deep in the Mac ecosystem.
There is an argument for the Surface things, but I also feel like Microsoft has not. There have been issues when it comes to speed and some choices they've made. Like, remember the Surface, what was the one that kind of rocked a little forward? The Surface Studio laptop. But it was too slow. It had like a quad core chip a couple of years ago, and we're like, what are you doing? This is supposed to be like a pro level computer. I hope Microsoft kind of reshapes things. I still like the Surface computers. I believe it was Harry McCracken. Yeah, Harry McCracken just recently posted a piece that he wrote around Windows 8. If you look him up on Mastodon, he used to, I believe, write for Time and didn't get published there. So it was really, this is a weird time because I believe it was around 10 years ago that Microsoft announced Windows 8. I was at the launch event for that in Barcelona, because that was a big change for them. That was like going mobile, and the Surface came shortly after. And it's just weird to reflect on all that and be like, well, Microsoft is just, Windows is back, and they just make laptops now. The whole tablet laptop thing has kind of died off. But we'll see. Maybe they will have some surprises for us this year. Let's move on to another bit of news. The dumb Elon Musk corner. How about that?
Because we have to talk about
that. We have to talk about it real quick. Some dumb things. Every time I look down, I tried to stay away from news when I was on vacation. I was in Tybee Island, by the way, for a week, which is off the coast of Savannah. You could just drive there. It's really cool. It's really chill. And I tried to stay away from Twitter and other news sources for a while, but I did look down at some point and be like, Elon Musk saying, maybe we should just remove the block feature, and sighing my head on the beach and being like, this idiot. Because a lot of people who have covered social media for a while know that there are some basics you need to be on the App Store or to be on the Google, Play Store. And one of those is a feature that allows users to block people who bother them. That's like a basic feature. So him like thinking out loud, being like, oh, maybe we should just get rid of this. Maybe it's just unfair to people. Will likely never happen.
Yeah. And the thing that I had heard that is probably just like gossip and people making jokes is that Elon hates the block feature because apparently Grimes has blocked him, his not quite ex-wife, but another one of his baby mamas.
Yeah, I mean, good for her, except she knew exactly what she was getting into. Anyway, that's the whole thing.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like Grimes's whole heel turn is incredible to me because for a while she was like a like art school goddess.
Yeah.
Everyone that I knew who went to like the tiny liberal art schools were like, man, she's so cool. And then she just became like a techno supervillain. It's crazy.
Anyway, lots of dumb things happening. Musk also says he wants to remove link headlines and text on Twitter to improve aesthetics, which I believe he spelled wrong.
Okay, yeah, like the idea is like to make things a little bit more compact when you're looking at your feed.
It has to be more useful because all you get is an image now, maybe.
Yeah, okay, and what good is it for headlines? I think that it's also really important that we talk about, and we don't have this in the show notes, how for a little while X was throttling connection to various news sites. And then I think the Washington Post published an article about how they were maybe Elon just had beef with. And
let's say he bought Twitter.
It stopped soon after that. But man, one person should not have all of that power. I understand that like the way I use Twitter and the way you use Twitter is very specific. It is for news. We are thinking of it as a wire service. But I think that's pretty important. Like, yes, it's a place where culture happens, but it's a place where culture happens because it's a place where news happens.
Yeah. As another failed celebrity once said, no man should have all that power.
yes.
There was also a piece by Ronan Farrow, which I think everybody should read. It's at the New Yorker. It's called Elon Musk's Shadow Rule, which is about how much the US government and the Ukrainian government and countries all over the world end up relying on him because he's the guy providing internet service to Ukraine with Starlink. And basically, if he felt like it, and he seemed to be wishy-washy about it, he could turn off internet for Ukraine and potentially affect things quite a bit. There are some quotes from like Ukrainian commanders who are like they get to the front lines basically and they lose internet and people are dying because they geofence the how far space Starlink would actually serve.
And that is incredibly political then. Like people say, oh well, it's tech, not politics. No, the idea of where the geofence ends is entirely political.
So, and he in public he's also been like, I've talked to Putin, I think he has some good ideas, here's a peace plan which involves Ukraine giving up and giving things to Putin. This is to be clear, this entire war was started by Russia. It's an aggression against Ukraine to take over Ukraine. And
I'm just surprised that Starlink actually works that well.
I mean, Starlink works. Here's the thing, what's infuriating about Elon Musk is that his stuff can work. A lot of it does work. The SpaceX rockets are being used by NASA and other companies. Like, the idea of reusable rockets are good, but the guy at the top is a moron. So he just keeps talking.
Well, yeah, and let's be very clear about this. Elon is standing on the shoulders of a lot of engineers who are really committed to low orbit internet access and really committed to like all the things that they do at SpaceX. And he's like a guy with a bullhorn on top of that whole pyramid of people saying, I did this.
He has the money. He has been making a lot of money since selling companies in the mid 90s. And this piece goes over into a lot of that. But there is a quote from a Pentagon official, which I think really wraps this up. Living in the world we live in which Elon runs this company and it's a private business under his control, we are living off his good graces. That sucks. End quote.
That's so like plain for a mouthpiece of the American military to say. That sucks.
I think everybody should read this piece because it's a lot of good insight. Also, I've read some of the Elon Musk biography, so it retreads a lot of that stuff. But there are some quotes from like his friends and people, his first wife, who, if you look at videos of him, like when he got his first McLaren or something, like it was his fiance at the time. They had like a very tempestuous divorce. But even at that time, she was like, oh, we could just become rich, spoiled brats because of this, all this money. So,
That was the beginning of his villain arc.
That was, you could argue the beginning was being raised under
apartheid.
So there was that too. Anyway. And
so some AI news, too. Let's talk about
that.
Yeah,
let's end the dumb Elon Musk section. There's also some AI news. A judge ruled that AI-generated art isn't copyrightable since it lacks human authorship. And that's kind of interesting. Let me see here. The judge, Judge Beryl Howell of U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia, said copyright has never stretched so far as to protect works generated by new forms of technology operating absent any guiding human hand, as plaintiff urges here. Human authorship is a bedrock requirement of copyright. So I have seen some, responses to this judgment. I think it makes sense on paper, but there are also things. I think there are also some examples of, work being used. Was it the case of the monkey that took a photo has been copyrighted?
I want to get specific about what prompted this ruling. So this computer science professor, Dr. Stephen Thaler, sued the U.S. Copyright Office because he was trying to copyright this one image. And this image is like of a beautiful old railroad covered by like lots of plants, kind of like dappled sunlight and everything. And he said that this is my intellectual property because I programmed the AI that made this thing. The judge said that since the AI is actually the thing that made this thing, you cannot copyright it. I understand this professor's point of view. I'm very happy that the judge ruled against him.
Because the professor didn't program everything, right? He created a model which was trained on pre-existing things, I believe is what happened, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you look at the image, you should go look at the image on the Engadget website. It's interesting, but you can see that this is, like, I have seen the images that this was trained on. I've seen this picture on Reddit. Like, this is one of the pictures one of the 50 or so pictures that come up on Reddit R pics all the time. How are you going to try to copyright something that is kind of looks like basically a double exposure of like this combined with maybe some like brighter colored flowers? I think the judge in this case was right in her ruling. And what do we think? Can we prognosticate about whether or not this has anything to say about the WGA and SAG strikes? Neither of us are legal eagles, so maybe not.
No, maybe not anything directly, but it is fascinating to see this decision being made while at the same time so many creatives are worried about like what the potential for AI will be. I think people have a right to be worried, like the worry isn't that AI will destroy humanity. It's that it can slowly chip away at things like this, at the idea of creativity and ownership and art. And I don't know where that's going to lead us. It's going to lead us to a world where Netflix makes crappier and crappier movies. I feel like I look at some of these right now, I'm thinking of, Red Notice, a lot of the ones with The Rock and Gal Gadot. You're just a copy of spy movie formulas that have been around for a while, and they're popular, and you get a couple of popular people in there. They've been making B-movies like that for a while, but to throw a ton of money at it and to promote it the way Netflix does, I just feel like you're making garbage. Like, this isn't art. There's no soul to what you're making here. I think this stuff will lead to soulless art, and that's what worries me.
The idea of a post-scarcity society is a bit more abundance for everyone, not the people who own the AI tools having even more than they do right now.
Right. Precisely. So anyway, let's move on to what we're working on. I mentioned I'm working on a review of this LG Ultra Gear 49, which is a very, very fine monitor. I'm also working on a review of a haptic gaming chair, which I still need to like fully think about. But hey, there's a lot of gaming stuff going on. I'm going to be in a rumbling chair playing on a 49-inch monitor, living the dream, everybody. Is there anything you want to shout out, Ben?
So, yeah, in terms of Engadget, we're looking forward to all of the stuff coming in September, Techtober sort of stuff. Like, there's not a lot that we can say about, like, specific dates right now, but, like, stay tuned. But can I plug a personal project?
Sure. This is your space.
Okay, yeah. So I've been trying to get this idea off the ground of a show about people who've legally changed their names. So if you have a interesting story about people who have legally changed their names, if you yourself have legally changed your name, or if you know someone who has a very interesting story about them changing their name, please send us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Do a little like summary of the story, and maybe I'll get back to you, because I'd like to come back to this personal project, and what I really need is more folks to talk to.
Nice. Cool. Good luck with that, Ben. Actually, real quick, I want to mention, I got a question from somebody on Twitter that I think is actually going to be really relevant to us right now. I have to look up this person's name, but several people have messaged me about like TV advice, and like, has my suggestions changed in 2023 compared to other years? Typically, I'd say, like, go get an LG OLED or go get, like, whatever you can afford, you know, that's not the cheapest thing, like maybe a nice mid-range TCL 6 series or something. I have noticed that Wirecutter and a lot of other places are shifting their recommendations over to Samsung's new S90C OLED. And what's interesting here is that this uses the new QD OLED technology, which we've talked about on the show here before, slightly
quantum dots
OLED. And it's slightly brighter, has slightly punchier colors. And I'm surprised that a lot of reviewers are like, yeah, this is good. This is actually better than LG's stuff. LG's TVs are still really, really good. And I've seen some incredible deals, insane deals. I bought a 77-inch OLED for my dad. I think it was like $1,500 in April. Just in 77 inches. I've seen the 65s go below that price quite a bit too, and not like the basic level models either. LG's OLEDs are still good. If you want Dolby Vision, which honestly, I think you should probably get a TV with Dolby Vision if you really want this stuff. The LGs are still very, very good, but I think you should just go in person. Go look at those Samsung S90Cs. And I wish I had space to do like TV reviews and stuff, because I just want to see this thing in action more. But I have seen, I've seen some QD OLED stuff. That Alienware gaming monitor I reviewed several months ago had QD OLED. It's incredible stuff. So screens are getting better. Keep an eye on all those things. And as always, folks, if you have any questions, drop us an email at podcastengadget.com, or, you know, shoot me an email. Shoot me a note on Twitter. What is it now? If it's not a tweet, it's an X, it's a post. I don't know. I'm always going to call it Twitter. Shoot me a tweet.
It's a letter from your ex.
It's a letter from my ex. or Mastodon or Blue Sky. And I'm on Threads, but I don't really check Threads. So anyway, let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. What do you got, Ben?
Okay, so I think I'm going to recommend an album, but it's inside a story because I can't help but telling stories. Man, that's why I got into this business. So recently I've been doing gymnastics for adult beginners. I started doing it in March of this year, and it's a lot of fun. I did not know how to do a handstand or a cartwheel before this.
Right there with you.
But now I'm pretty decent at cartwheels and stuff. I am now at the like gymnastics ability of a fourth grader or so. It's also a great way to like listen to new albums. The folks at the gymnastics gym that I go to put on these new albums, and I would never have heard this album Fountain Baby by a R&B artist Amare if it hadn't been playing at the gymnastics gym. This is a really great, like, smooth, kind of sexy R&B album. And it also, like, kind of crosses genres. There's one track. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think it might be track 9, track 10 or so, where it literally just sounds like a Japanese punk song. And then it goes back to, like, really smooth R&B. It's cool. Check out Fountain Baby by Amare. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm definitely going to talk about Ahsoka, but now that you're talking about albums, I do want to shout out JPEG Mafia's, like, big one that we released this
year. Oh, my God.
So good.
Wait. Yes. Hold on.
Yes. I'm going to say
I had no idea that you knew anything about Peggy.
I know Peggy. I know a little bit about Peggy. Well, specifically, what got my interest was, like, I've seen his mixes and stuff around, but there is this one track, Kingdom Hearts Key, which features Red Veil, which samples the opening of The Vision of Escaflowne, which is just like, I don't even know what's happening anymore. The anime series I watched when I was a preteen in, like, 1996 is now the source, like, just the source beat, the source melody for this track. It is, it's pretty good. So talk about, like, using, like, Japanese punk influences. It's just, he's, like, straight up J-pop.
Okay, yeah. No, I had no idea that we were going to talk about JPEG Mafia. JPEG Mafia is one of my favorite rapper producers right now. I think that he's totally incredible. I think that his point of view on the world is dark, but very valid.
He seems like a cool dude. Like, I get it. I can be kind of dark at times, too.
I'll watch any interview with him. He did a, like, half-hour interview at Cambridge Union. This is, like, okay. Cambridge yeah. University yeah. in England. And just ended up sounding super, super smart. I think that he's, like, really treading new ground in terms of being a producer. And he could quit rapping tomorrow and still be completely changing the game just by production.
It's pretty cool, dude. So his new album is Scaring the Hoes with Danny Brown, which I'm saying yeah. on this podcast. It is Scaring the Hoes. It's a great album. And specifically, like, I love Lean Beef Patty, which is the opening track. Like, there's just a lot of great inventiveness here. But I just was blown away to hear The Vision of Escaflowne's opening. I'll send you a link, Ben, to it. And maybe we will.
I think I've heard it, yeah, but yeah, I'll listen to it again.
We will. You could just, like, sample a bit in here in this episode at some point. So here, have a listen at Kingdom Hearts Key. Just one time, stick thick. All that money, you're flesh in a blink. Try to dribble, go give me a ring. You got money, you don't gotta think. I was chilling one time, this thing. Let the app now get what you think. Feel like Ezra when I'm on the scene. All these felonies that I've seen. Got my cup.
Okay, so you also wanted to talk about Ahsoka on Disney Plus. So tell us more.
Yeah,
about
I reviewed Ahsoka, which is the new Star Wars series, the live action one that people have been waiting for a very long time. And I think it's fine Star Wars, but man, I did not expect this to be a direct sequel to Star Wars Rebels, which is the cartoon series that ran from 2014 to 2018. And it's just one of those things where it's like, man, it just expects you to have all that knowledge, to know these characters, to know about what's happening. I've always been fascinated by the character of Ahsoka. I never really followed Rebels that much, but I've basically spoiled myself because I think Ahsoka is really intriguing. I think some of the narrative twists that they added to that show, to Rebels, were really interesting. Like, Rebels, spoilers for Rebels, spoilers for stuff that's going to be happening in Star Wars, but Rebels basically introduced the idea of time travel and space-time travel, and, like, it kind of did the thing that Game of Thrones did towards the end, where there was a major fight where Ahsoka, I believe, was fighting Darth Vader and was struck down by him. And at the end of Rebels, they go back and save her by pulling her through a hole in time.
Okay.
Yeah, that happened. Sure. That's canon. That's Star Wars.
That's
silly. That's
silly.
But
that feels like it's breaking the Star Wars universe, to be honest.
So I think Dave Filoni, who's the creator of this and who has been the guy behind all the animated series, I think.
And I generally trust
Dave
Filoni, trust
him too. This is the guy everyone's like, yeah, this is the successor to Lucas, basically. Like, if anybody were to be the caregiver of Star Wars as it is, and not just Kathleen Kennedy, the producer, it would be this guy. On a storytelling level. And I think the show, like, it has great lightsaber battles. I love Rosario Dawson. I think the wider cast is very, very good. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is here as one of the characters from Rebels. It's basically all the characters from Rebels. Sabine is here, played by Natasha Liu Bordizzo. She is fantastic. And the late Ray Stevenson also shows up as a big bad, as the new villain. I don't think we call them a Sith, but he is, I think they're Inquisitors. He's a bad guy with a red lightsaber. And I love Ray Stevenson so much. And yeah, it is, I think this is like, it is both sad to see him and also amazing to see like this guy that I started loving on the show Rome continues to kick ass. The show is fine, but man, it really just be any idea of like emotional beats or character motivation, it all ties to Rebels. And if you haven't seen it, I feel like God help you, because the show doesn't give you much. It's like, you know, Ahsoka's...
So this is the Marvelfication of the Star Wars universe.
Sort of.
Very frustrating, honestly.
I feel like even the Marvel things like play it a little safe. Like they get you in somehow, even if like you missed out on the key piece of something. Whereas this just feels like, oh, yeah, they're just throwing you in the deep end, you know? And this is different from a show like Andor, which I also loved, which I think is a difficult show to watch at times too, because you kind of have to... You don't really know these characters. It's a really complex plot and setup, but once you stick with it, Andor becomes amazing. Whereas this one is like, well, they're doing Star Wars stuff, and we don't know why she's going after this bad guy. We don't know this Ezra character, who is the main character of Rebels, who disappeared at the end of Rebels. It's a whole thing. She is seeking out Ezra. That is her main motivation. She's seeking out Emperor Thrawn, which is they assume if they find Thrawn, they will find Ezra. There's a lot of like emotional heft to these things that is just not explained in the show. And I feel like that could have been done more deftly. The show also does the thing that The Mandalorian honestly did a lot of times. It's just all fetch quests. There's a lot of fetch questies. You got to get the key. You got to get a map. You got to get the key to read the map. You got to follow the map to the thing to talk to the person. It's a lot of that. And I do love Dave Filoni. This is entirely his baby. Ahsoka is entirely his creation. I think he basically got the go-ahead from Lucas to be like, well, what if we told a story about Anakin's Padawan? Anakin's Padawan. And basically made this whole thing. But I wish, as more of a general Star Wars fan, like I like Star Wars. I just didn't. Honestly, I hated the animation in Rebels. I tried watching season one. It looks like really bad Disney XD animation, because it was, which is unfortunate. I didn't feel so adrift by this thing. So let me know what you think, folks. Ben, let me know if you end up seeing Ahsoka. Rosario Dawson's very good. The lightsabers are very good. I still get a thrill from a lightsaber, you know, fight. And I think they're shot well. The action is pretty good. There's some good action bits all around here. But it just really takes a while to get going. And something this cool, featuring characters this cool, shouldn't feel like a slog.
Okay, so that's all for this episode. Our theme music is by video game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor of Engadget, Terrence O'Brien, and the podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
I'm still at Devendra on Twitter. I'm at Devendra at mastodon.social on the Elephant site, and I'm at Devendra on Blue Sky as well. I'm on Threads, but please don't message me.
Literally, if you want to get in contact with me, just email me at benelman.wave@gmail.com. I am not on a lot of the other platforms. If you want to take a look at my last tweet on X, that was in November of last year. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, because it really does help. It helps us like climb the ranks. It helps other people find us. We're on everything where you can get podcasts, and we will see you next week.